we are going to discuss Yom Ha'atzma'ut. First, a few prefaces. First of all, how one views any issue in the world has to be through Torah eyes and halacha, and not just an hashkafa, and not just your gut feelings, what you think, how you feel about it, positive or negative. And therefore, any discussion of Yom Ha'atzma'ut, the state of Israel, whatever, has to be done within, for a Torah Jew, within Torah guidelines, halacha and hashkafa. Secondly, what one holds of the state of Israel, or the day of independence of the state of Israel, and how one celebrates it or doesn't celebrate it, is no indication one way or the other of how he holds of Eretz Yisrael. Because the settlement of Eretz Yisrael in modern times is something that was promoted by two Gedolei Yisrael, who everybody has a connection to at least one of them, and most of us, I guess, to both of them, and that is the Vilna Gaon and the Baal Shem Tov. They both wanted to come and settle in Eretz Yisrael themselves. When they were, when it was impossible for them to do that, they sent their Talmidim after them to settle Eretz Yisrael. And the modern settlement of Eretz Yisrael in the last 250 years began with the students of the Vilna Gaon in Yerushalayim, the Prushim, and the students of the Baal Shem Tov in Tveria, Tzfas, and so on. So, and the mitzvah of settling in Eretz Yisrael, and the chashivas of Eretz Yisrael, the godless of Eretz Yisrael, is something that was promoted by Gedolim of every generation, including our own, the Chazon Ish, the Ger Rebbe, the Chofetz Chaim, all said that the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael applies even today, like the Ramban, and all of them paskin lahalacha, there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael today, whether you have to live here, what the conditions are that would enable you not to fulfill that mitzvah, that's not for now. But that the person who lives here is fulfilling a mitzvah, that is pretty much muskim by the Gedolei Haposkim that we follow. On the other hand, so therefore someone who is anti Yom Ha'atzma'ut and anti the state of Israel could be a very big lover of Eretz Yisrael, as much of the Neturei Karta is. People in Neturei Karta live in Eretz Yisrael. They wouldn't think of leaving Eretz Yisrael. There are 7-8 generations here in Eretz Yisrael. Some of them have never left Yerushalayim on principle. And yet they are violently against the state of Israel, which we will explain why. On the other hand, people who are gung-ho for the state of Israel may not have any love for Eretz Yisrael or what Eretz Yisrael stands for at all. In fact, there was a minority contingent of the world Zionist movement in a point in its history that was willing to settle for Uganda to be the place for the Jewish state and not Eretz Yisrael altogether. So the fulfillment of secular Zionism is not necessarily Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It's a different concept altogether. So Eretz Yisrael and Medinas Yisrael really do not depend one on the other. Thirdly, this topic is an extremely emotional topic, and people react to it emotionally, and therefore it's not something that people look at in a very intellectual, cool, collected, halachic manner, and that makes it even more difficult to discuss. Why is it so emotional? Here in Eretz Yisrael, my feeling is that it's very emotional because there's not a family here, Israeli family, that doesn't have somebody in the family or extended family that wasn't killed defending this country, fighting in one of the wars, in terrorist attacks or whatever, and that makes the issue very, very emotional. Somebody who they perceive doesn't care about the state that their loved one died to create or defend, it becomes very emotional. Very emotional. And there's other reasons why it's emotional. On the other side, like we said, the original Yishuv here, before secular Zionism, was a firm Yishuv. And the Zionists came in, the secular Zionists, and they took over. And they made a war against the firm Jews here, trying to secularize the country and secularize them before the state. And make education that's secular or whatever, And there was mamash, they waged a war, and they stole away the control of the yishuv from these people who were here. So you could understand that deeply embedded in these people and their descendants is a hatred for the secular Zionists, and the state they equate with secular Zionists. In America, it's also a very emotional day. Right? People get into fistfights over saying Hallel or not saying Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut. In, I don't know which communities you're in, but whichever you can remember, I'm sure that there were very strong feelings on both sides. I mean, there's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch whether you say Hallel with a bracha on Rosh Chodesh or not. We hold that you say Hallel with a bracha even if you daven in your house. And the Vilna Gaon holds, based on earlier Rishonim, that if you daven Hallel with a tzibur, the tzibur, one person in the tzibur says a bracha for everybody. If you daven alone, you don't say a bracha on Hallel, on Rosh Chodesh. I never saw anybody get into a fist fight over saying Hallel with a bracha on Rosh Chodesh or not. It's a halacha. If you hold like this, you hold like that, just like any halacha. There can be differences in opinion, halacha-wise. But in my shul in Miami, the main shul didn't change anything in davening on Yom HaTzmaut. Davening, regular davening, with Tachnun, without Hallel, it was regular davening. And if there's time, I'll explain to you. If not, maybe the next class I will go into, it will be before Yom Yerushalayim, and maybe we'll spend a little bit of time on the halachic ramifications of changing davening, saying Hallel, not saying Hallel, making a Yom Tif or whatever. And in any case, but I allowed, there was a B'nai Akiva group that met in my shul, and I allowed them to have a room in the shul where they had their own minyan on Yom HaTzmaut, and they said Hallel without a bracha. That much I allowed them to do. So everything went fine. The people who wanted to go to that minyan went to that minyan. The people who wanted to come to the main shul minyan came to the main shul minyan on Yom HaTzmaut, and Shalom al Yisrael. Until one year, I overslept on Yom HaTzmaut, and I came to shul late to find that nobody was davening, but there was a big circle in the hallway outside the shul, and everybody was cheering something on. And when I got through the circle, I saw two middle-aged doctors beating each other up. What had happened was the following. There wasn't a minyan of people in the B'nai Akiva minyan at 7:30 when davening was supposed to start. So one doctor, who was an ardent religious Zionist, went into the shul and asked some of the older men if they would come to help make the minyan in the B'nai Akiva minyan until people showed up and they'd have their own minyan. Another doctor, who was an ardent Neturei Karpinik, anti-Zionist, saw him doing this, and he went over to him and said, not only are you an apikoros who says Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut, but you're a nesis of Mediach. You are convincing other people to do these terrible aveiros. So they started yelling at each other. It happened to be these two doctors didn't like each other anyway, so it's a good excuse. And they started yelling at each other, and then led to fists, and they were having an out-and-out boxing match in the middle of the hall of the shul with everybody else standing around, towels and filling, cheering on their favorite. In any case, so why is it so emotional in Chutz Laretz? So I think one of the reasons is that most religious Jews who live in Chutz Laretz have to have some, if not subconscious, guilt feeling that they're not living in Eretz Yisrael. Because Lamaise, how could you be a frum yid and not think that it's a chashiv to live in Eretz Yisrael? So there are two ways to placate your conscience. Some people do it by becoming ardent Zionists. They sing Hatikvah at the drop of a hat, right? They what's it called, sing Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut and fly the Israeli flag all over their living room. And this way they feel, okay, I don't live in Eretz Yisrael, but I'm gung-ho, you know, for the state of Israel. That takes the place of living in Eretz Yisrael. And there are people who go the other extreme, right? They are anti-Israel. Eretz Yisrael is a traitor place because the Zionists took it over, and therefore I don't feel guilty for not living in that traitor Medina, right? Today, Eretz Yisrael is traitor because the Zionists are there. So either way, people can placate their consciences for not living here by either being super Zionist or anti-Zionist, and that's why it's to a certain degree an emotional issue in Chutz Laretz Lefi Aniyas Daiti. Okay, let's now see what I want to do, and I'm sorry I don't have more time. I would have gone on extra time just to finish this. But in any case, we'll see if we can condense it enough to make it the whole thing make sense. So you get everything I want at least to give you without a lot of maybe the details, historical details that maybe aren't necessary. But what I want to accomplish here is the following. I want you to appreciate in a cool, calm, collected way why there are differences of opinion, where they come from, right? I don't think I'm going to influence anybody here to change their hashkafas, but at least you should understand why there are different hashkafas from the ones that you have, and appreciate it, respect it, that it has a basis to it. And what doesn't have any basis in halacha or in hashkafa is not rishkait, is worse than not rishkait. It borders on something that's baltosif or baltigra. Okay, so you should appreciate what the issues are here, right? So you can understand them and explain them. At least you can explain why you do what you do, and not just, well, that's the way we feel. Right? And you can understand why other people do differently, whatever that may be. So let's start with the formation of secular Zionism, the Zionist, political Zionist movement, which was founded by Theodor Herzl in the end of the 1800s. Theodor Herzl himself was an assimilated Jew whose parents were assimilated. He was a Viennese journalist, and he was very much troubled by the fact that Jews were persecuted with anti-Semitism. And he wanted to solve the problem of anti-Semitism. And I am sure that the Rabbanu Shel Olam will reward him, or is rewarding, or has rewarded him, for his feelings of feeling bad that Jews suffer. He was the brunt of anti-Semitism, but he wanted to solve the problem of anti-Semitism for Jews world over. That was his, he dedicated his life to that. And I am sure that the Rabbanu Shel Olam will reward him for feeling the pain of Klal Yisrael and wanting to do something about it. But his solutions were horrendous. I'm sure he will not be rewarded for his solutions. What were his solutions? When he was a young man, his solution was mass conversion to Catholicism. If all Jews were to convert to Catholicism, then the Goyim won't hate us anymore. Which makes sense. If there are no Semites, you can't have anti-Semitism. So, he wrote in his diary at this point in his life, his proudest day will be the day that the people of his town will march to the Catholic Church with the priest and be baptized. However, he gave up this great idea when Dreyfus was put on trial. Dreyfus was an assimilated French Jew who was an officer in the French army. He was accused of being a spy, all trumped up, framed, anti-Semitic. It led to tremendous anti-Semitism in the world, right, focused on Dreyfus the Jew, and Herzl realized that Dreyfus was not a religious Jew, that he wasn't hated because he was religious. Doesn't make a difference if you convert, you don't convert, you're assimilated, not assimilated. The Goyim hate us no matter what. So he came up with another idea. You know why the Goyim hate us? Because we're not normal. We live in other people's lands, we speak their language, we take advantage of their economy, we're parasites. And that's why Goyim hate us. And therefore, if we'd only be normal, like the rest of the nations of the world, and have our own land, our own language, our own post office, our own army, our own national identity, economy, we would be like all the other nations of the world, and they treat us equally to everybody. That was his philosophy. That was his thesis. And further Zionist thinkers, like Ahad Ha'am, added other things. We would have to be normal like the nations of the world in other ways, too. We'd have to have our own criminals and our own perverts, too. That's what he said. And when we would have all of these things, just like the nations of the world, we would be normal and nobody would hate us because we're Jews. Okay, so therefore, Herzl founded the World Zionist Movement, which was an organization whose goal was to secure a place in Eretz Israel, since Eretz Israel was the historical homeland of the Jews, a place where the Jews could be politically independent and develop their national identity, language, country, and so on and so on. And that would cure anti-Semitism in the world. We see today that we have our own country and our own language and our own economy, and we have our own army and our own post office and our own criminals and our own perverts. And we are very, very normal, and the world loves us, and anti-Semitism has been solved. Okay? Not only hasn't it solved the problem, it created a new problem. Because now, anti-Semites can respectfully hate Jews. Because before, they just hated all these Jews with the long noses, right? And that wasn't very respectable and refined. But today, they don't hate Jews. They hate Zionists. Right? Zionism became racism. All those Zionists are people who oppress the poor Palestinians. So I don't hate Jews. I hate Zionists. Who are the Zionists? Everybody from the Naturi character to the most assimilated Jew. They're all Zionists. All those guys with the long noses, they're Zionists. So they hate Jews, but they hide behind the mask of Zionism. They hate Zionists. And they refine the anti-Semitism. So Zionism didn't solve the problem. It created a new problem of a refined anti-Semitism. In any case, that's for the most part irrelevant right now. So that was Herzl's dream, and he founded the Zionist movement. In the beginning, there were many frum Jews and Choshev Rabbonim that joined the Zionist movement. Because what could be wrong with wanting to settle Eretz Israel and have a place in Eretz Israel for Jews to be able to live, independent? Right? Europe wasn't a great place for Jews. And to leave Europe and to have a place where Jews could live together, what's so terrible about that? So many frum Jews joined the Zionist movement. There was a group of Rabbonim and Yidden that were opposed to the whole concept, even if it only meant getting a political place in Eretz Israel, even if it'd be frum. Because they held that when we went into Gaulis, the Gemara says one of the conditions of Gaulis, which the Gemara phrases as a shvuah, an oath, that we took when we went to Gaulis, but it doesn't literally mean that we took any oaths. It means that was a condition of the Gaulis, was Shelo Yalu Bechoma. We would never take over Eretz Yisrael en masse. We'd never return to Eretz Yisrael en masse before Mashiach. That's the Gemara. And they held that getting a place in Eretz Yisrael where we would have a state, where Jews could just come any time, that's awesome. Most Gedolim didn't hold from that. They held that taking Eretz Israel en masse meant taking it by force. We weren't allowed to go and fight the Goyim to take back Eretz Israel. But if the nations of the world would permit us to go back to Eretz Israel, like they did in the time of Vayesheni, the Persians, then that wouldn't be a problem. So said the Or Sameach, or Meir Simcha Midvinsk, who was one of the Gedolei Israel of the time, that if the nations of the world would give us permission, then it wouldn't be a problem of Yalu B'choma. But there was a contingent, a minority, who held that it was Usser. Otherwise, most held that it was a very positive thing, and why not try to get control over part of Eretz Israel politically and let Jews be able to settle there. There were movements already before political Zionism of settling Eretz Israel, and this was a boost. However, very early on, the Zionist movement decided that they were not going to limit themselves in securing a place in Eretz Israel to be independent. But they would be involved also in chinuch, in education, and in culture. Meaning the Zionist movement would not content itself to just be a political movement to secure a place in Eretz Israel, but would also be a movement that would be involved in forming and shaping the nature of Klal Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael. What kind of nation would it be? And since the early Zionists were basically taken over, the movement was taken over by the Russian Maskilim, whose whole agenda in Europe was to secularize the Jewish people and to make them a secular, enlightened people, enlightened meaning throwing off the yoke of Torah, so they had that plan for the Zionist movement. We will create a tzibur in Eretz Israel that will follow our understanding of what the Jewish people should be, a nationalistic body defining a Jew as nationalistic, meaning what defines a Jew is not Torah. You don't have to be religious, you don't have to keep the Torah. Torah was made mainly for Golus. And in Eretz Israel, as long as you live in the Jewish country and you speak the Jewish tongue, then you are a good Jew. And you could even be a Christian, said Achad Ha'am. But if you're a patriot to the Jewish entity, the Jewish national homeland, you're a good Jew. And if you're a frum Jew and you're not a good patriot, you're not a good Jew. Judaism is defined by nationalism. That is apikorsis. Rav Sadia Gaon says, Judaism is defined by the Torah. Ein umasenu uma ela b'torasa. Our nationalism is defined by the Torah, not the opposite way around. So that philosophy is apikorsis. To the point where one of the choshuvah rabbonim of the time, who I will let you guess who this Rav was, said the following. He wrote the following. He didn't say it. He wrote it. He wrote the following. He said, if the Zionist movement continues to make Eretz Israel the substitute for Torah, that all you have to have is the land of Israel and speak Hebrew and you're a good Jew, right, then we rabbis are going to have to de-emphasize the whole inyan of Eretz Israel, even though Eretz Israel is very important. And we're going to have to take Eretz Israel off the agenda completely. And he said there's a precedent to that. In the time of the Second Beis HaMikdash, the early Christians said that the only thing in the Torah that is significant is what's it called, is the Ten Commandments, the Aseres HaDibros. At that time, we were saying the Aseres HaDibros as part of Tefillah. Along with Kriyashma, every day, we said in Birchas Kriyashma, the Aseres HaDibros. So the Rabbanan took the Aseres HaDibros out of davening, and they asked anyone from saying the Aseres HaDibros as part of davening. Why? Because they said it's misleading. Since the early Christians are saying that the only thing relevant in the Torah is the Aseres HaDibros, if we Rabbanim are going to permit people to say the Aseres HaDibros as part of Tefillah, then we're misleading them. We're giving them the feeling that the Christians are right, that the Aseres HaDibros is what makes it special. So they took the Aseres HaDibros out of davening and de-emphasized their importance. Said this Rav, we're going to have to do the same thing with Eretz Israel. If the Zionists continue to say that Eretz Israel is a substitute for the Torah, then we Rabbanim are going to have to de-emphasize the importance of Eretz Israel in order that people shouldn't be confused. And we're going to have to totally remove Eretz Israel from our agenda. Who do you think that Rav was? Who? Satmar Revi was a kid at the time in 1911. Any other? Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld?
No.
Who? The Chafetz Chaim? No.
Nitziv?
No. Rav Kook said that. Just to show you that no one held that the philosophy of secular Zionism was anything less than apikorsis. That's not the issue. Everybody held that a philosophy that says that Eretz Israel is the only thing a Jew needs to be a good Jew, and nationalism defines the Jewish people, which is what the secular Zionist philosophy became, is apikorsis. No one held differently. Not Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld and not Rav Kook. Their difference of opinion was something different completely, but not in that area. Okay. In any case, eventually, very close to that, the secular Zionists voted officially that they would deal with culture and with what's it called and with education. And at that point, the religious factions that were within the Zionist movement pulled away and separated themselves from the Zionist movement. And they started another organization called the Mizrahi. That's how the religious Zionists got started. They pulled away from the Zionist movement because they voted that they would have to do with culture and education, meaning that they will reform and reshape the Jewish people to be a nationalistic people and not a people defined by the Torah, and they couldn't feel comfortable being part of a movement that was its agenda. And therefore they pulled away. They started the Mizrahi. At the same time, around the same time, another organization started called the Aguda. Now the difference between the Aguda and the Mizrahi was in many areas, but the major differences that we're concerned about were the following three things. Firstly, the Mizrahi had a philosophy based on various Rabbanim that preceded Rav Kook, even though Rav Kook was the one who enhanced this philosophy, that it was a positive thing to have a political entity in Eretz Israel before Mashiach comes. Not only that, but that's how the Geula comes. First, you redeem yourself politically, leave Galus, go to Eretz Israel, and that's the beginning of the Geula. And then the Geula develops until HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends Mashiach. And it culminates with Mashiach. It doesn't start with Mashiach. It ends with Mashiach. And that's called Reishis Michas Gulasenu. The beginning of the dawn That's the Medrash says that the Geula is like the dawn. It occurs slowly. They understood that to mean that it would develop slowly until it would reach the sunrise of Mashiach. But the way that you develop it is by redeeming yourself politically, physically, economically from the nations of the world, and then the Ribbono Shel Olam will bring Mashiach. So they saw the formation of a state of Israel in Eretz Israel as an intrinsically valuable thing and the beginning of Geula if it could be done. Rov Gedolei Yisrael, who were part of the Aguda, including the Chafetz Chaim and the Ger Rebbe and the, most of the Gedolei HaChassidus and Rosh Yeshiva, Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, Polish Rosh Yeshiva, and so on, who joined the Aguda, held differently. I heard personally from Moshe Feinstein, Amish, I was sitting where I'm sitting now, and he was standing where you're sitting, and he was giving a shiur, and I heard him say, Beferish, that the whole concept of Reishis Michos Gulasein was a mistake. It's not true. It doesn't exist. There is no idea that Geula starts before Mashiach comes. Geula starts with Mashiach. That which Chazal meant, that Geula happens slowly, is after Mashiach comes. The Rambam says that. Right? So Rav Moshe Feinstein happened to be one person who didn't hold of this philosophy. There were others who held it. Yes, they did hold of this philosophy. In any case, but he held that that idea that Geula starts when you redeem yourself and has anything to do with political autonomy is not true. But the Mizrahi held from this philosophy, and they held therefore that there's an intrinsic value in reaching the goal of the Zionist movement of having a political entity in Eretz Israel. They also held that since that would initiate the Geula, that was the major issue facing the Jewish people at the time. And that should be the major issue on the agenda of the Mizrahi. And thirdly, they held that even though the world Zionist movement, the ideology was basically apikorsis, but we could work together with them on the common ground that they had. They wanted a state, and the Zionists wanted a state. They wanted it for their reasons, the Mizrahi wanted it for its reasons. So we can both work on the getting of a state, and then we'll find it out what the state should be. Okay? They even had ideas that once Yidden went to Eretz Israel, they would be transformed automatically into Frum Jews, because only the Gaulists that made them, that's what a cook held, that what's it called, that once Jews came into Eretz Israel would have a tremendous effect on them, and all these un-Frum Jews and would become Frum overnight, or at least in a very short amount of time. The Maisa, that has not materialized. Jews have been in Eretz Israel for tens of years, and if anything, they become more hardened anti-religious. But in any case, this was the feeling. The Aguda and the Gedolim of the Aguda argued on three of these things. First, they said there is no intrinsic value to have a state of Israel before Mashiach comes. There were those that said it's also to have, like I told you, because it's called Yalu B'choma. Most of them said it's not also to have, but there's no intrinsic reason, Dafka, to have a state, but there is an intrinsic value of settling Eretz Israel, but it doesn't have to be with political autonomy. You can make an arrangement with the Goyim who run the land, just like we lived under Goyish rule in Eretz Israel during many periods in our history, and the Makai in the midst of Yishuv Eretz Israel, right, under Goyish rule. That was one thing they disagreed with. Secondly, they said, therefore, settling of Eretz Israel was not the major issue facing the Jewish people in Europe at the time, in the 1911, 1912. The major issue was the economic status of the Jew that was on the verge of collapse, and the economic status of the yeshivas, which were on the verge of collapse. They said Jews had lived in Gaulis for 2,000 years without Eretz Israel, but they couldn't survive a week in Gaulis without Torah, and therefore the major agenda was saving the yeshivas and not settling Eretz Israel, even though they said that there is definitely a positive thing of settling Eretz Israel, and they would work on that too, but that was not the major agenda. And the third area that they disagreed with the Mizrahi is that the Mizrahi said they could work together with the Zionist movement from without, and the Aguda said there's no way of working together with the Zionist movement, not because people involved in it are not from, but because it's a movement that has an ideology, and the ideology is apikorsis, and you can't work together with an ideology that's apikorsis. That's awesome. That was what the Gedolim of the Aguda Paschim, and they compared it to two people who want to build a church, I want to build a building. One wants a church and one wants a shul. You can't say there's common ground. We both want walls. So we'll build the walls together and then we'll decide if it'll be a church or a shul. Right? There's no common ground. Either it's a shul or it's a church. It can't be both. If you want a state of Israel to be the replacement of Torah, that's not a state of Israel. That's Al Pi Torah. So you can't have it both ways. So there's no common ground to work with an ideology that is apikorsis. That was the psak of the Gedolim of Agudas Israel, and the Rabbanim of Mizrahi held differently, and they held you could work together with the Zionist movement, not from within, but under the same umbrella. Okay, in any case, Herzl was very unsuccessful. He tried the Turks. Turkey was in control of Eretz Israel at the time. He tried very hard to bribe the Turks, pay them, convince them, whatever, use political pressure, and he got nowhere. And basically he died with a broken heart over the fact that he didn't see any chance that, that they would ever get Eretz Israel. For the most part, even the early Zionists who went to visit Eretz Israel were not impressed with the land. It was a very dismal land, full of malaria, swamps, and wasn't very appealing. And that's when this idea of maybe being given Uganda instead of Eretz Israel came up. That's a little bit later. The British government wanted to give the Jews Uganda in place of Eretz Israel. And there was a minority that were willing to accept it, temporarily or even permanently. Lamaisa, it was voted down by the majority of the Zionist movement, and Eretz Israel was the goal. And Lamaisa, nothing happened on that front until after World War I. During World War I, the Jews in England helped very much financially with the war effort of England against Germany, and the English had a debt of gratitude to pay, and also the Zionist movement made it clear that they would help any way they could with the war effort if, after the war, England would become the victors and they would take over Eretz Israel from Turkey. They would have the mandate over Eretz Israel that they would enable the Jews to have a state there. And Lamaisa, after the war, because the Jews, Lamaisa, were valuable in winning World War I for the English, and the English did become the controllers of Eretz Israel, they somewhat made good on their promise, their, unspoken promise, and that was the Balfour Declaration. In 1917, Lord Balfour made his famous declaration, which said basically that the English government looks favorably on the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine, barring any opposition from the indigenous residents, meaning the Arabs. Okay, this was not a great thing. It didn't say we're going to give you it. It said we look favorably upon it. It didn't say how much. It didn't say when, what, where. Just, we have a nice idea. We look favorably on this. They say that when the Chafetz Chaim heard the Balfour Declaration, he cried. And he said, what are people rejoicing? This is what we waited 2,000 years in Gaulis for some goy to promise us in vague terms that we can have a homeland in our homeland. This is the gedula that people are celebrating, the Balfour Declaration. On the other hand, they say that Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld heard the Balfour Declaration. He was extremely happy. And when his Talmidim asked him, what's you happy about? I mean, nothing's happened. Just, you know, some goy proclaimed that they look favorably on maybe having a homeland in Eretz Israel without defining what that means. Right? Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld told him the following. He said, imagine if there had been a drought for 2,000 years and there wasn't a drop of rain for 2,000 years and no clouds in the sky for 2,000 years. And you wake up one morning and you see a little puffy white cloud in the sky. Wouldn't you be happy? It didn't rain yet. It's not even a rain cloud. But something's changed. For the first time in 2,000 years, there's a cloud in the sky. Something to be happy about. So too, for 2,000 years, nobody's been talking about resettling the Jewish people in Eretz Israel. All of a sudden, a goy is already talking about giving a homeland to the Jewish people in Eretz Israel. Something to be happy about. In any case, the British very quickly realized they made a big mistake, because the Arabs were not very happy about the Balfour Declaration, to put it mildly. And the Arabs started to make pogroms and uprisings, and the British realized that they had more to gain from the Arabs than the Jews, and they quickly tried to make the Balfour Declaration basically irrelevant. They had a famous white paper that they produced, which limited Jewish immigration. They made it very hard for Jews to live in Eretz Israel. They favored the Arabs. They didn't stop Arabs from killing Jews. The British were extremely, extremely not fair and not nice to the Jewish people who were in Eretz Israel, not to the Zionist movement outside of Eretz Israel, limiting how many Jews could go into Eretz Israel, not to upset the status quo of population, right, in favor of the Jews. And for all practical purposes, between the two world wars, nothing advanced too much on the Jewish homeland in Eretz Israel. What changed all of this was the Second World War. Prior to the Second World War, after Hitler arose to power in 1933, there was 6 years before the World War broke out in 1939. During those 6 years, things got worse and worse for Jews in Europe. And when they tried to leave Europe to go to any other country, they found that no other country wanted them in. Famous stories of the St. Louis boat that went around the world and finally had to come back to Germany and were sent to the concentration camps. No country wanted Jews. And after the war, it was even worse. After the war, the thousands of Jews that were left from the concentration camps couldn't go back home. They couldn't go back to the Ukraine, to Poland, to Hungary, whatever, because if they did, they were summarily murdered by the Poles, Lithuanians, Ukrainians, or whatever, who had taken their homes, who had helped the Nazis kill Jews, and hated the Jews worse than the Nazis did. So they had nowhere to go. So no country wanted to take them in en masse either. They had very strict quotas, especially for Jews. And therefore, the only hope was Eretz Israel. The British were still in control of Eretz Israel, and they didn't let Jews in because they didn't want to upset the Arabs. So Jews that tried to get into Eretz Israel were sent to camps in Cyprus and kept there by the English. So it became obvious to Jews world over that if we don't have a state in Israel that's controlled by Jews, there's not going to be any place for these Jews to go, and Jewish life is in immediate danger. And therefore, all the factions, the Aguda, the Mizrahi, and the secular Zionists, banded together at least to put a united front in front of the United Nations. The United Nations appointed a commission to decide what to do with Palestine. And that was called the Peel Commission. And the Jews had to appear before this commission and argue their case. And all of them agreed with certain stipulations and conditions that they would not object to a state. Even the Aguda, no one would object to a state knowing that it's Pikuach Nefesh. Even though they didn't held that it's not necessary to have a state or whatever, but under the circumstances it was necessary to have a state, because if there wouldn't be a state, Jewish life would be very much in danger. So they all went before the Peel Commission and they said that they want a state, which didn't give the United Nations a piss home pair to say, well, if you don't want it, why should we want it? And in 1947, in November, the United Nations voted to partition Palestine, a portion, a very small portion, to the Jews, a larger portion to the Arabs in between the Jews, making it almost impossible for us to have a normal state. And they felt that it would last maybe a few days and the Arabs would throw us into the sea and they'd be finished with the Jews. But in any case, the United Nations voted to partition Palestine and to give the Jews the opportunity to declare a state in Palestine. That was in November 1947. That was a miracle. It was the only vote till the end of the Cold War that Russia and America voted the same way for. In any case, now the rulers of the pre-state Jewish agency or whatever had to decide whether they were going to declare a state or not. Because the Arabs said, the day the Jews declare a state, we are declaring a war. And all the Arabs around will kill every man, woman, and child in Palestine and throw them into the sea. That's what they said openly. You declare a state, we declare war. So the Shiloh, what to do? On the one hand, declaring a state meant facing, I don't know how many, seven, eight Arab nations who surrounded us, right, with a war. We had an army and we had no army. A fledgling army, okay, but no real organized army at the time. Or, if they didn't declare a state, Jewish life would be in danger because there was no place in the world to go. And the English weren't letting anybody in. But in any case, the mandate the English mandate was over on May 16th, which was a Shabbos. Ben Gurion, after they decided they were going to declare a state, arbitrarily decided that he's going to declare the state a day early on May 14th, which was Friday, instead of waiting till May 15th, because if he declared the state on Shabbos, it would cause all kinds of logistic problems, many problems. And he didn't need the problems that could be caused logistically by declaring it on Shabbos, and therefore he declared it on Friday, May 14th. So Hey Ear, which was May 14th then, was basically an arbitrary day that was chosen to declare the state. Nothing happened on that day, right? Not even the mandate of the English running out that was anything special. It just was the declaration of the state on that day. That's what happened on Hey Ear. And it was supposed to happen the next day, but Ben Gurion decided to do it a day early. In any case, that's what happened, the declaration of the state. The day they declared the state, two things happened. The borders of Eretz Israel were open to all these Jews who were in the camps in Cyprus where they could come into Eretz Israel, and a war started. The War of Independence did not end on Hey Ear, it began on Hey Ear. And Arabs attacked, and many Jews, hundreds of Jews, lost their life on Hey Ear, on Yom HaShmaut, that first year. Jews who came from the concentration camps into Eretz Israel, the night of Hey Ear, Friday night, came into the land, had a place finally to put their feet down on Jewish territory, were given guns, sent to the front, and many of them didn't see the light of day. They were killed that night in the War of Independence. So, and this war went on for months and months with the loss of much Jewish life, but miraculously, in the end, the state of Israel still existed. Okay, the enemies were not able to destroy the state and drive us into the sea, Baruch Hashem. But the truth is, the war never ended. It's still going on today. It just had a lot of intermissions. Then there was a 1956 Sinai War. Then there was a 1967 Six-Day War. The 1973 Yom Kippur War. The Lebanon War. And we're still in a war of attrition today. So the war really never ended. The same Arabs are still trying to throw us into the sea on a daily basis. Okay. In any case, you can understand, therefore, why the three different factions amongst religious Jews looked at the day that the state was proclaimed in three different ways. The Mizrahi saw this as the beginning of the Gula. So it's a tremendous Yom Tov. Okay, that's a war, we have to fight for it, and the Gula happens in stages, and it's sometimes very painful, but it's the beginning of Gula. Shibud Malchus is over. So a very positive day, very happy day. This is the beginning of Gula. The Neturei Karta, who said that aside from the Pikuach Nefesh, immediate Pikuach Nefesh issue, the having of a state of Israel is a wrong thing, it's usur, and it pushes away Mashiach, they saw it as a day of mourning. Especially since the state of Israel, very in the beginning, right, wasn't clear what this state would be. What laws would it adopt, right? There were people who hoped that it would adopt the laws of the Torah, that there'd be Batei Din, not Batei Mishpat. Right. However, right away, the Knesset made it clear, basically the majority of the people who were running the state were not Frum, were sometimes anti-Frum, communists or whatever, socialists, who were anti all religion. They decided that the country is going to be run on secular law, it's going to be a secular country, and only the status quo would be kept with the religious Jews of whatever in the time of the mandate would not be changed, and that was that. So they said that a state that's called the State of Israel, and it's a secular state, and not based on Torah law, where the court system is a secular court system, is a Chilul Hashem, that if that should be called Israel, that's not Israel. Right? It's something totally not based on Torah, it calls itself Israel. So the Torah character says it's a Chilul Hashem. You can't have any connection to such a state, and the state is a negative thing, and it pushes away Mashiach. Right before the state was established, when it was clear that there was going to be a state, there was a big machlokas within the Agudas Israel, how to look at the state. The Neturei Karta, which eventually became the Neturei Karta, those, the Golem and Rabbanim, said that just like secular Zionism is apikorsis, the state is the manifestation of secular Zionism. The secular Zionists now have their secular state. So it's no different than the movement. And just like the Golem said, you can't have a connection to the movement, you can't have a connection to the state. most Gedolei Yisrael, the Litvisha Rosh Hashivas, most of the Hasidisha, the Ger Rebbe, the Chazonish was amongst them that held that that's not the same thing. A state is a fact. It's parif. It's not an ideology. It's not a movement. It's a state. It's a democracy. What defines the state is who is in control. How do you get control? By using the political process. Therefore, most Gedolim said that not only can't you divorce yourself from the state, but you have to be involved in the political process to salvage what you can. Because if you're not, you're giving it into the hands of the people who will make the state their way. So you have to try to make the state as much Torah as you can. So therefore, the Chazon Ish and others and the Gedolim of the Aguda held that there's a mitzvah to be part of the political process, sometimes in the government, sometimes with the opposition. The original Aguda was part of the government. They signed on the Declaration of Independence, and they held as a mitzvah to vote until today in elections, because if you don't, then you're giving it into the hands of the secularists. And the only way to fight it is from within, by going with the political process. The Neturei Karta held, you can't differentiate between a state and a movement, and you're not allowed to have anything to do with the state. And the Mizrahi held, yes, the state is not what we want, but the state itself is the beginning of Geula. So you can understand, Hashkafa-wise, how they looked at the state. However, whatever you think, positive, negative, in between, to make a yomtiv because of the establishment of the state of Israel every year is not such a simple thing. Okay? First of all, just the establishment of the state itself and the fact that Jews could return to Eretz Israel and live in political autonomy in Eretz Israel is not, l'chora, the reason to establish a yomtiv. I'll prove it to you. Who knows the day that Yoshua ben Nun established as the yomtiv that they celebrated every year when they went into Eretz Israel the first time and conquered the Goyim there, and they were able to live in peace in Eretz Israel the first time around. There was never such a yomtiv. How about when Ezra went to Eretz Israel the second time? What was the day of the year that they celebrated every year the Yom HaAtzmaut of the Shivas Zion in Bayesheni? Or even better, what was the day they celebrated the building, the completion of the building of Bayesheni? When they completed Bayesheni, they made a yomtiv. But they didn't celebrate every year. They celebrated a Siyum on the Beis HaMikdash. But they didn't celebrate a day every year that celebrated the building of the Beis HaMikdash. So it's obvious, and even the Mizrahi people who celebrate it realize that that's not a reason. You can't just make a yomtiv because you feel like making a yomtiv, or you think that something great happened, because that's called Bal Tosif, that's adding to the Torah. A yomtiv is a halacha thing. In order for it to have the status of a yomtiv, even a minor yomtiv, it has to have a halachic basis. You can't just make new yomim tovim, that's called Bal Tosif, it's adding onto the Torah. There is a place to add yomim tovim, b'horayah, this Chanukah and Purim, which were not part of the Torah. But there's a reason and there's a halachic basis how to make a yomtiv like that, what it's able. First of all, the Chazon Ish held that no one has the power today. Chanukah and Purim, both of them were established by either the Sanhedrin or by the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, which were the body that made halachas for all of Klal Yisrael. Today, says the Chazon Ish in his time when the state was proclaimed, there is no body in Klal Yisrael that has the authority to make anything for the entire Jewish people, to make any halachas for the entire. We don't have that anymore. We don't have the Sanhedrin, we don't have an Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, we don't have that body that could make a halacha, a takana, anything, a fast day, a yomtiv day, anything for all of Klal Yisrael. That was the Chazon Ish's opinion. However, for communities to make yomim tovim, that we know that they've done. That is halachically not only permissible, even advisable. I have a personal yomtiv on Vav Shvat, where I don't say Tachnun that day, right? Because I had a fire in my house, and we were saved miraculously, and I make a personal yomtiv every, my family has a yomtiv that day. We don't say Tachnun that day, but I do say Tachnun Yom HaTzmaut. And I'll explain to you why, the difference. So communities, and Chassam Sofer reports that his community, Frankfurt on Main, had a yomtiv that they had. They didn't say Tachnun. Every year on that yomtiv, there was a miracle that happened in their community, and they're the yomtiv. What is the criteria like Purim? Purim is the basis for any private, individual, communal yomtiv. That is, if a miracle happens to a community or an individual where his life wasn't threatened or the life of the community was threatened, and they went from, on that day, life to death to life, even if it was a hidden miracle, it didn't have to be an open miracle, then that day can be established as a minor yontif, meaning you don't say tachanun, you don't say halal on that day, you don't say tachanun, you're not allowed to say a hesped, or a, what's it called, fast on that day, and if it coincides with days of Avelis, like Sfira, you can listen to music and dance and whatever, it's your personal yontif. Just like if somebody has a bris, during Sfira, he can take a haircut, and he can, what's it called, listen to music on that day, because Sfira, for him, is abrogated by his personal yontif. Okay. Let's see if Yom HaTzma'ut fits that criteria. Did a miracle happen on the fifth day of Iyar, where Jews' lives were in danger, and because of that miracle, they no longer were in danger? No. So let me tell you both sides. Some say yes. Why? Because until Hay Iyar, until the state of Israel was proclaimed, the lives of many Jews all over the world, especially the ones outside of Eretz Israel, were in danger, because they had no place to go. Now that the state was proclaimed, their lives were basically saved because they had a place to go. They'd come into Eretz Israel. What's the Svara not like that? Oh, sure, they had a place to come in Eretz Israel. But on Hay Iyar, that wasn't the day that their lives were really saved, because many of them were killed that day because another Tzara took over that same day that a war started called the War of Independence. And that war, for most practical part, never ended. So Hay Iyar itself wasn't a day where Jews went from death to life, right, with a miraculous thing. It didn't happen. It was an arbitrary day. It was just the day the state was proclaimed. And just the fact that the state was proclaimed is not enough of a reason to make a yontif. It has to be death to life situation with a even hidden miracle. And that doesn't describe Hay Iyar. And therefore, even Gedolim, who were very pro-Zionist, Mizrahi people. And when the state was Rav Ovadia Hadaya was the head of the, is a Sfaradi, head of the Beis Din in Yerushalayim. He has a tshuva saying basically this thing. Hay Iyar is not a day that fits the criteria of making a yontif, therefore it doesn't abrogate the laws of Sfira. And you have to say kach. There were those that said no. The Maisa, there was a saving on that day, at least from one Sarah, and that's enough. Okay. What about Hallel? Even if you, I don't say Hallel on my yontif, because Hallel has another criteria. Hallel is that most Jews in the world had to have a miracle that was not the Derech HaTeva happen to them, like the miracle of Hanukkah, right? And it affected most Jews in the world whose lives were in danger, and most Jews were saved. That's true. But not if it's only a portion of the Jews, not the majority of Jews in the world. So, even the Rabbanut originally said, we can't sanction saying Hallel with a bracha, because it really isn't sanctioned. This miracle, even if it happened, even if you consider this saving from death to life, but it didn't happen to most Jews. Most Jews lived in America, their lives weren't in danger. When Rabbi Gorin became chief rabbi, he changed the psak. And he said you have to say Hallel with a bracha. And his reasoning was one of two things. Either that potentially all Jews could be in danger at some time in the future, right? And now that we have a place called the land of Israel, the state of Israel, that danger isn't there. So it affected all Jews theoretically. The theoretical danger was taken away theoretically. You can understand why most Gedolim would not agree with that. Secondly, he said, even if you don't go for that, but there's a halacha that sometimes the majority of Jews in the world is calculated by the majority of Jews in Eretz Israel, and the Jews outside of Eretz Israel don't count. Specifically, one halacha of Par Helem Dover Shel Tzibur. If you have the Beis Din, the Sanhedrin in Eretz Israel, and they make a mistake in Pesach, and they paskin that something that's Osir Bekares is Mutter, and most of the Tzibur follow them, then there's a special carbon you have to bring, okay, called Par Helem Dover Shel Tzibur. If most of the tzibur didn't follow them, then you don't bring that carbon. How do you determine most of the tzibur? So the Gemara is very clear. If you have 10 million Jews living in Chutz Laaretz, and 7 Jews living in Eretz Israel, and 4 of the Jews in Eretz Israel follow the Beis Din, that's considered a majority of Jews, even though there's 10 million outside of Eretz Israel didn't follow the Beis Din. The Jews outside of Eretz Israel don't count. Only the Jews in Eretz Israel. Said Rabbi Gor, if that's the case, then the majority of Jews over in the world were affected, because the majority of Jews were the Jews considered in Eretz Israel, and them, the majority were affected by this. That, most Gedolim hold, is not true, because that is only for that halacha that has to do with the Sanhedrin, with Karbanos. It has nothing to do with halachas that have nothing to do with Sanhedrin and Karbanos and Eretz Israel. You count all Jews all over the world, the Gabi this, when the Jews are in danger. So, halachically, to say halal with a bracha is very, very difficult to support halachically. In fact, even the Rabbanut, up until Rabbi Gorin, held you shouldn't say a bracha, and that's, I think, what most people do. Don't say a bracha, even if they do say halal. To say halal altogether is questionable, and to make a yontif, most Gedolei Yisrael hold that there's no place for yontif, including Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik from Yeshiva University, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, once walked into a B'nai Akiva minyan on Yom HaTzmaut, and he saw them saying halal and saying a haftorah and a host of other things, and he walked out of the minyan very upset and gave a 2-hour shiur to people, few people who were there who I know, and I heard a tape of the shiur also, and he blasted that this is totally non-halachic. And you don't do things that are non-halachic just because you like the state of Israel, so all of a sudden you make a yontif out of a day that's not a yontif. He was, you can't accuse him of being anti-Zionist or anti-Israel. He was the head of the Mizrahi. What? No, he's upset about the entire service. And what he was more upset about was not so much the Hallel or the Tachnun, but the Haftorah. He said there are things that have no basis in halacha at all. And just to do them, right, in some places, and this was not created by the Rabbanut, this was created by the Kibbutz Artsi movement, right? Leil Yom HaTzma'ut, in many places, they get together, they say portions of Lechadodi, they daven Marav with a Yomtif Nigin. You don't do that in Chanukah and Purim. Is Yom HaTzma'ut a bigger Yomtif than Chanukah and Purim? Right? Lechadodi is for Shabbos, not for the middle of the week. Right, they blow shofar, they sing animam, and I think everything but lulav and esrog, right, and maybe eating matzah, right. That's like, you know, my gut tells me I want to go overboard. That's not halachically, and a person who's based in halach and understands what Yiddishkeit is, it's not just a free-for-all, as Rabbi Soloveitchik was extremely upset, to say the least, and all the people who were there at the time, and heard from him and saw how he was, this is not a halachic thing. Yes, to make a yontif and not say tachnun and even to have music during Sfira, there's a basis for that. Most Gedolim don't hold of it for the reasons I told you. But somebody who does it, I have to respect that there is such a basis for that. There are legitimate halachic sources that say such a thing. If you don't have a Rebbe who you follow for everything, then you have to follow the Das of Rov Gedolei Yisrael, and you can't make it a yontif. And you can't abrogate the laws of Sfira. If you have somebody you follow in everything and he tells you, this is how I paskin, then you can follow him, it's on his shoulders. But that I can understand, respect, but people do things that have no halachic basis. Just because in their gut they feel like they want to go, you know, overboard either one way or the other way. There's people who do the opposite also on Yom HaTzmaut, and they make it Eichen, Kinos, or whatever. Also may have no halachic basis to it. People do things just because of their gut. That's not Torah. That is borders on Avodah Zorin and Baltosif. So, again, I hold one way, my Rebbeim held one way, I can at least accept, respect, and tolerate people who do a different way, who have a basis in halacha for what they're doing. Okay? Even though I don't agree with their basis in halacha, but that's like everything, there's difference of opinion. But people who do it just because how they feel, politically, right, or ideologically, that is not a kosher way of functioning in any issue in Torah.